The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ed Tremblay from the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the Tar Heel Junior Historian Magazine, North Carolina History for Students. Today I'm going to be reading to you from the fall 2019 issue, which is called She Changed the World, North Carolina Women Making History. And the first article today will be Women's Colleges in North Carolina by Marissa Fowler, Morgan Johnson, Inaya Rivera, and Angela Robbins. Marissa Fowler and Morgan Johnson are senior history majors. Inaya Rivera is a sophomore history major. And Angela Robbins is an associate professor of history, all at Meredith College. Could you imagine going to a school with just girls? Historically, colleges and universities were segregated by gender. But since the mid-1900s, most schools have become co-educational, that is, the education of both male and female students in the same institution. However, North Carolina remains home to several respected women's colleges that have educated thousands of women in the past century. Although each school is unique, they share a common bond of sisterhood. This unity on campus has created a personal experience for the women who have attended these schools. Many women's colleges in North Carolina were founded in the late 1800s. At that time, most people didn't think women needed to be as educated as men. So why were women's colleges funded? Often, women's colleges were created with the support of religious organizations. These organizations believed that since women were responsible for raising children, they needed to be educated to fulfill this role as effectively as possible. Salem College, the first women's college in North Carolina, was founded in 1772 by the Moravians in the community now known as Winston-Salem. Meredith College in Raleigh was chartered in 1891 and supported by Baptists. Bennett Seminary, now Bennett College, is a historically black college founded in Greensboro in 1873 by the Methodist Episcopal Church. Starting off as a co-educational institution, Bennett College became a women's college in 1926. Early colleges for women were actually more like high school and did not offer degrees because women were not expected to pursue a career outside the home. A student who completed a course of study at a women's college could apply to a degree program at one of the schools in the University of North Carolina system, but few women did. The first woman to graduate from UNC Chapel Hill did so in 1898, more than 100 years after its door opened. Like all colleges, most of the early colleges for women were exclusive to upper-class and white students. These schools were almost always private, meaning that students' families had to pay to attend. After the Civil War and the end of slavery, Barber Scotia College in Concord and Bennett College in Greensboro were both chartered to educate black women because established women's colleges did not admit them. The state began operating its first public college for women, the State Normal and Industrial School in Greensboro, now the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, in 1891. Like other women's colleges, State Normal focused on practical skills for women who planned to enter the job market until they married and started a family. The State Normal and Industrial School started with three primary departments: Normal, which prepared graduates to become teachers; Business, which taught courses in typewriting, stenography, and bookkeeping so that graduates might work in an office; and Domestic Science, which taught courses in cooking, sewing, and other skills important to household management, since most graduates would become full-time homemakers. By the early 20th century, More young women thought about entering a career, and many schools responded by changing their curriculum. State Normal students were able to train for careers in nursing and social work, and the school also expanded its liberal arts offerings. Over the years, some women's colleges have broadened their educational mission and have become co-educational institutions. In many cases, this was done to attract more students so that the schools could better meet the educational needs of their communities. William Peace University in Raleigh, the University of North Carolina at Greensboro, and Greensboro College were all established as women's colleges, but over the past 70 years have begun admitting men. This change at many former women's colleges across the nation shows the shift in women's rights over the 20th century. Women no longer needed a religious justification for their education, and it has been normal for them to attend college alongside men for many years. Today in 2019, women are making history by going to college in larger numbers than men. Women also outnumber men in postgraduate programs like law and medicine. This is significant because throughout United States history, women were excluded from most colleges and universities. Although more women have begun attending coeducational schools, women's colleges still play an important role in society today. Statistics show that only 2% of female college graduates in the country attended women's colleges, yet graduates of women's colleges make up 20% of women serving in Congress and 33% of women on the boards of Fortune 1000 companies. Women's colleges, though not as common as they once were, offer a unique educational experience with a strong emphasis on community that empowers and unites graduates in a bond of sisterhood. Here are the captions accompanying the photographs that came with this article. A group of Peace College students on the green tennis team. Tennis was one of the few ladylike sports that were considered appropriate for women of the time. This image appeared in the 1919 Peace College yearbook, The Lotus. Flora McDonald College, circa 1910 to 1916. It later became part of coeducational St. Andrews Presbyterian College. Salem Academy and College students on the steps of the Main Hall building in 1889. This graduating class had the distinction of being welcomed at the White House by President William Henry Harrison. The first graduating class of the North Carolina State Normal and Industrial School, the first state-supported institution of higher education for women in North Carolina. The two men are professors. Known as Women's College, it later became the University of North Carolina at Greensboro. The Bennett Bells of Bennett College have a history of political activism. They joined sit-ins at the Woolworth's lunch counter in Greensboro, started by four North Carolina A&T students in 1960. But even before then, the Bells protested against segregated movie theaters and the way black women were portrayed on the screen. This group of Meredith College students, identified as Gan, Bunny, Peggy, Elsie, MB, PD, and Janie, posed for a photo in their dorm room. The photo appears in the 1916 Oakleaves yearbook. Here's a Think About It sidebar article. Today, we may sometimes take education for granted. Sometimes we even complain that we don't want to go to school. But what if you were not allowed to learn to read or write just because someone else said so? What if someone tried to stop you from learning? Throughout much of history around the world, education was not thought to be important for girls, and many schools would not even allow them to enroll. Why do you think some groups have tried to keep others from learning? What happens to someone when they can read and learn for themselves? What impact do you think early women's colleges and educations had on the women's suffrage movement? The next article is You Have to Start a Thing, North Carolina Women Fight for the Right to Vote, by Raylana V. Poteet, who is the curator of political and social history at the North Carolina Museum of History and curated the museum's exhibit, You Have to Start a Thing, about the fight for women's suffrage in North Carolina. Have you ever been the first person to believe in something or to stand up for what you think is right? Being the first to support a cause may make you feel excited, but it can also be lonely and scary. Can you imagine being one of the first women in North Carolina to stand up and publicly say that women deserve the right to vote? Today, that seems like a no-brainer. Was there really a time when people thought that women weren't just as entitled as men to have a say in their government or to run for office? For centuries, both men and women have believed, that women's place was in the home, as a wife and mother, not in the public sphere of business, politics, and voting. Wyoming gave women the right to vote in 1869, and slowly, some states in the western part of the United States followed. By the early 1900s, activists in many parts of the country were campaigning for women's suffrage, women's right to vote. But the South, and North Carolina in particular, was a very socially conservative place, where even most women opposed the idea. So imagine the bravery it took for the first Tar Heel woman to call for suffrage, for the right to vote in an election, to stand up, speak out, and put their voices into the oppressive silence all around them. In Asheville in 1894, Helen Morris Lewis and her friend Florida Cunningham became the first two women to publicly advocate for women's suffrage and start a women's suffrage group in our state. Helen was a member of a national women's suffrage organization and believed that more North Carolinians would support suffrage if they better understood the cause. So she organized and gave a speech at a meeting in the town courthouse. The Asheville Citizen Times reported, agitation for women's suffrage in North Carolina had its beginning in Asheville last evening. Asheville's mayor introduced both women and offered his support. A week later, he hosted a meeting where both women and men formed the North Carolina Equal Rights Association. Helen was elected its president. In 1897, the association convinced a state senator from Yancey County to introduce a bill to provide for women's suffrage in North Carolina. But legislators promptly referred the bill to the Committee on Insane Asylums. Yes, a joke. And it never received a vote. Despite Helen's efforts and enthusiasm, her organization petered out by around 1900. More than a decade passed before any new action was taken. Then in 1913, a few scattered local suffrage leagues began forming. Several Morganton women marched in the town's 1913 Women 4th of July parade, carrying Votes for Women banners. 2 weeks later, they formed the Morganton Equal Suffrage League to aid in securing equal suffrage. In September, Ella Clapp Thompson started a league in Bakersville in Mitchell County. In October, 7 women got together in Charlotte to create our first statewide suffrage organization, the North Carolina Equal Suffrage League. North Carolina was the last state to form one. These initial founders were all either from Charlotte or were related to someone who lived there, but the league quickly added members from across the state. During 1914, the National American Women's Suffrage Association sent one of their professional organizers to North Carolina. Lavinia Engel spoke in cities and small towns, promoting the benefits of women's suffrage and helping to form more local leagues. Barbara Henderson, new president of the state league, called for additional members, saying, "Women of Carolina, your state needs your service. For the sake of your homes and your children, lay aside your smaller tasks for the time and flock to the standard of a larger service." The suffragists worked hard to convince North Carolinians that women's suffrage was fair, just, and inevitable. They wrote letters and newspaper articles, sponsored suffrage lectures, and lobbied legislators. By the end of 1915, local leagues had been formed in Charlotte, Raleigh, Greensboro, Asheville, Morganton, Hickory, Bakersville, Winston-Salem, Salisbury, High Point, Chapel Hill, Reidsville, Henderson, Kinston, New Bern, Goldsboro, Greenville, and Washington. But most North Carolinians were still not on board with women's suffrage, and not all the leagues were still active. Even by the end of 1917, Lula Roberts Platt, president of the North Carolina Equal Suffrage League, or North Carolina Equal Suffrage Association, as it was also called, could only report on 175 members statewide. In comparison, our neighboring state, Virginia, had 115 local chapters and thousands of members. Over time, more and more North Carolinians slowly became persuaded that women deserved the right to vote, and the North Carolina League increased its membership. But many citizens and politicians hadn't changed their minds. The state legislature chose not to become the final state to ratify the 19th Amendment to the Constitution, which reads, "The right of citizens of the United States to vote shall not be denied or abridged by the United States or by any state on account of sex." But when Tennessee ratified the amendment, it still became the law of the land in August 1920. Here are the captions for the accompanying photographs. Three of the founders of the North Carolina Equal Suffrage League, Anna Forbes Liddell, Suzanne Bynum, and Mary Bell Palmer, rode on this Votes for Women float in May 1914 parade in Charlotte. Despite many well-known national suffrage parades, this is the only suffrage float historians have documented in a North Carolina parade. These enthusiastic students from the State Normal and Industrial College, now UNC Greensboro, were likely encouraged in their activism by their history and political science teacher, Harriet Elliott, who was herself a prominent suffragist. Charlotte Hawkins Brown, born 1883, died 1961, founded Palmer Memorial Institute, a school for African-American children in Guilford County. She was also one of the founders of the North Carolina Federation of Negro Women's Clubs, the NCFNWC, service organization, whose motto was "Lifting as we climb." Brown supported women's suffrage, believing that it would not help just black women, but all African Americans. Brown continued to fight for voting rights her entire life. Here's a delegate badge worn by Gertrude Weil at the National American Women's Suffrage Association Convention in 1917. And a portrait of Helen Morris Lewis, president of the first suffrage organization in North Carolina. Look closely and you can see the Raleigh headquarters of the North Carolina Equal Suffrage Association and of the Anti-Suffrage States Rights Defense League side by side on Main Street, on Fayetteville Street. The headquarters for the Southern Rejection League was also just across the street. Awkward. Barbara Henderson, born 1880, died 1955, was a founder and the first president of the North Carolina Equal Suffrage League. Both she and her husband, University of North Carolina professor Archibald Henderson, wrote and spoke for suffrage across the state. She believed suffrage could only be achieved in North Carolina through a very conservative approach. She denounced militancy, promoted her status as a mother, and emphasized male supporters of women's suffrage. Gertrude Weil, Sally Dortch, and Cornelia German working at the North Carolina Equal Suffrage Association headquarters in 1920. Note that Cornelia's son and the family dog appear to be helping also. In North Carolina, most of the hard work of suffrage was done by women sitting at a desk, writing letters to potential supporters and legislators, drafting petitions, and writing speeches or articles for newspapers. There were no major suffrage parades or protests held here. Here's an associated article, Suffs versus Anties. Women and men who supported women's suffrage became known as suffs, while those who opposed it were called antis. We might find it surprising that some women did not want the right to vote, but there were plenty of Tar Heels who did not. Almost all the women and men who fought publicly for or against suffrage were wealthy or relatively well-off white people. While working-class whites may have had opinions about suffrage, most did not have the time or resources to actively participate in the struggle. And the suffrage of African-American and American Indian men was already severely limited by Jim Crow voting restrictions. Most suffs had a few things in common. They tended to be well-educated. At a time when far fewer people received a college education, many suffs attended university, some at well-known northern institutions, and a few even had advanced degrees. Suffs had exposure to life in other parts of the country or world. They were likely to have traveled out of state or to have moved to North Carolina from places where women's suffrage was more accepted. And they were more likely to work or to have worked outside the home. Antis were less likely to have received a college education or to have held a job. Their families were often wealthy landowners or textile mill owners or were associated with railroads. Families involved in managing North Carolina's large textile mill industry were particularly afraid that women would vote to protect workers' rights and limit child labor. Antis wanted to maintain a social structure that gave whites control over African Americans. They feared women's suffrage would allow black women to eventually overcome the Jim Crow educational requirements that had kept many black men from voting. And they feared that a federal suffrage amendment would open the door to the federal government telling southern states they could no longer limit the suffrage of people of color. The vast majority of suffs also wanted to maintain white supremacy, but they believed that women's suffrage would not affect white political control in the South. Next, a closer look, women who changed the world. Emmeline Pigott, born 1836, died 1919. During the Civil War, Confederate soldiers camped in an area near the Carteret County farm belonging to Emmeline Pigott's family. Pigott fell in love with a private in the 26th Regiment of North Carolina troops. He was later killed at Gettysburg. His death inspired Pigott to show even more devotion to the Confederate Army. She nursed wounded troops as well as delivered letters, food, clothing, and medicine across Union lines to Confederate soldiers. It is said that she hid these items under her large hoop skirt. She was once arrested in Beaufort for these actions. Pigott was mysteriously released from jail without being tried and lived the rest of her life in Morehead City. Catherine Ann Devereaux Edmonston, born 1823, died 1875. March 15, 1865. There will be many days this summer where we cannot taste meat, but what of that if our army is fed? These words are from the journal kept by Catherine Ann Devereaux Edmonston during the Civil War. Edmonston was born in Halifax County to a wealthy planter family. Well-educated, she and her husband Patrick Edmonston owned two plantations and more than 80 enslaved people. During the war, with her husband away, she helped manage the plantations in order to supply the Confederate Army with clothing and food. In book form, Journal of a Secesh Lady provides us with an insightful primary source about that period in North Carolina history. Anna Julia Cooper, born 1858, died 1964. Anna Julia Hayward Cooper was an author, educator, feminist, and civil rights advocate. Her accomplishments are outstanding for anyone at any time, but they are even more amazing because she was born into slavery in Raleigh in 1858. When the Civil War ended, Anna and her mother were freed. In 1867, St. Augustine's Normal and Collegiate Institute, now St. Augustine's University, opened in Raleigh, where 9-year-old Anna Haywood enrolled as a scholarship student. She would go on to earn both a master's and a doctoral degree. During her lifetime, Cooper experienced the end of slavery, worked to help women gain the right to vote, witnessed the end of legal segregation, and heard Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s 1963 I Have a Dream speech. In an interview at the age of 100, she aptly noted, "It isn't what we say about ourselves, it's what our life stands for." Jane S. McKimmon, born 1867, died 1957. In 1911, Jane Simpson McKimmon became North Carolina's first home demonstration agent. She led the movement to educate farm women about better ways to grow, prepare, and market their food in order to increase their family's income and standard of living. The McKimmon Center at North Carolina State University is named in her honor. Lula Owl Gloyne, born 1891, died 1985. Lula Owl Gloyne was the first member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians to become a registered nurse. She may have even been the first American Indian registered nurse in the country. When the United States entered World War I in 1917, Owl planned to travel to Europe as a field nurse, but extreme seasickness kept her stateside, where she served as a second lieutenant in the Army Nurse Corps, stationed in Camp Lewis in Washington State. Owl was the only member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians to serve as an officer in World War I. In the 1920s, Owl served her tribe and community as a United States Indian Health Service nurse, providing home, health, and midwifery services, especially to families living in the most rural sections of the Quala boundary. In the 1930s, Gloyne was instrumental in the founding of the first community hospital for the Cherokee tribe. Beulah Henry, born 1887, died 1973. Born in Raleigh in 1887, Beulah Henry was nicknamed Lady Edison. She is credited with the invention of more than 100 inventions. She received 49 patents during her lifetime, and was an incredible inventor and designer. Among her many successful inventions were the double chain stitch sewing machine, a duplicating attachment for typewriters, and a duplex sound producer. Henry founded two companies of her own and served as a consultant to many more. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of North Carolina History. Be sure to listen next time. I hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ed Tremblay, reading from the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.